From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Friday, January 30, 2009. President Obama says that when it comes to the economic crisis, organized labor is part of the solution. The economic stimulus screams Buy American, sparking a debate in the Senate over free trade. And did Israel use cancer bombs in their attack on Gaza? An FSRN exclusive with Con Hallinan. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. As controversy swirls about the Thai government's treatment of the Rohingya Muslim boat people, Myanmar Today denied the immigrants are actually Burmese. The government says the boat people, who came from the western part of Myanmar, are not a recognized ethnic group and consequently are not citizens. Claudia Cragg has more.
For their part, Prime Minister Abhisit's Thai government insists the Rohingya are not refugees and should be deported. However, the latest flux of 66 Rohingya have been processed by the Thai police in full view of the media, and human rights groups hope this is a signal that Thailand has dropped its unofficial policy of towing the immigrants out to sea and leaving them. However, the Thai government has now granted the UN access to the most recent group, but not to all the Rohingya refugees being detained by Thailand. Brad Adams is the Asian director for Human Rights Watch.
We believe we may have convinced the Thai government to, from now on, work with the United Nations and consider asylum applications and to launch an investigation into what happened. But we will see whether the Thai government really follows through on those commitments.
This latest group of Rohingya boat people have been charged with illegal entry and ordered to be deported. For FSRN, I'm Claudia Cragg.
As Sri Lankan government troops close in on what they say will be the final military confrontation in their battle against the Tamil Tigers, the international community continues to voice concern for Tamil civilians in the war zone. From Colombo, Ann Raber reports.
The Sri Lankan government is hoping that the Tamil Tiger rebel fighters will honor a 48-hour deadline to release all civilians who are living on the battlefront. The military has pledged not to fire weapons for 2 days to allow civilians living in the battle zone to reach safety in government camps. This battle, in the northeastern town of Mullaitivu, is said to be the last military front in the war against the separatist Tamil Tigers. The government has long claimed that the Tigers are using civilians as a human shield and won't allow them to leave. LTTE officials deny that, saying that civilians are afraid to leave Tiger-controlled areas for fear of abuse by the Sri Lankan government. Yesterday, the UN pulled 226 seriously injured civilians out of the battle zone. For FSRN in Colombo, I'm Ann Raber.
A unity government seems likely to go forward in Zimbabwe following an official decision by opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai to take up the prime minister post. Davison Makanga reports from South Africa, where the leaders met to forge the new government.
The Movement for Democratic Change's National Council gave the green light today to go ahead with the power-sharing deal signed last September. This follows the Southern African Development Community's order earlier this week, compelling the parties to form the shared government by February 13. The MDC says it is confident that the unity government will work to better the people of Zimbabwe. Party spokesperson Nelson Chamisa says disagreements between the MDC and President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party should be set aside.
We feel that the inclusive government provides a perfect opportunity and a window to try and stabilize our economy, to reconstruct our country, to make sure that we also heal the nation, to make sure that we also move forward in articulating our developmental agenda and democratizing our country. More importantly, we need to make sure that there is a platform for a free and fair election.
Some African leaders are still calling for Mugabe's ouster, but overall, the unity government in Zimbabwe is seen as the best opportunity to revive the economy's steady decline. Yesterday, the country's finance minister declared that all foreign currencies are now legal tender. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Davison Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
The Taliban announced they will allow female students in the Swat region of Pakistan to go to school through the fourth grade. This comes after the group demanded the closure of all Swat girls' schools earlier this month and the subsequent destruction of several of the buildings. From Pakistan, Afridi Afridi reports.
Residents of Swat welcomed the announcement, but most want the Taliban to allow girls' education to go further. A female teacher from a private school in Swat spoke to FSRN, requesting not to be named for fear of her safety.
It is very good to hear that there is some flexibility, but the Taliban did not say anything about the female teachers. I am not sure any women will teach until they say it is allowed. Most of my colleagues have left Swat because of the ban, as teaching was their sole source of income.
Although a Taliban commander announced to the international press they would allow limited girls' education, most parents in Swat aren't ready to send their daughters back to school. They are waiting to get permission locally on Taliban Pirate Radio, the only reliable source of information in the region. For FSRN, this is Afridai Afridi.
Following up on two stories recently in our newscast, a California judge has ruled Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger can force state employees to take 2 unpaid days off a month. California unions had challenged the governor's plan. Schwarzenegger proposed the cutbacks to help ease the state's financial crisis. And a California district court has thrown out a case brought by supporters of Proposition 8, who asked their campaign contribution information be taken down from the state reporting websites. They complained that supporters of gay marriage were harassing them and boycotting the businesses of contributors. The judge justified the decision, saying, if there ever needs to be sunshine on a particular issue, it's a ballot measure. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
President Obama launched a task force on the middle class today. The news comes alongside more dire economic data. The nation's GDP sank the most in the fourth quarter since 1982. But in Obama's announcement today, he said that organized labor is not part of the problem, but part of the solution. The president reversed 3 Bush-era labor policies, which will help workers stay informed, keep their jobs, and protect them from outside interests. FSRN's Karen Miller is in Washington.
At the White House today, President Obama's signing of 3 executive orders signified another significant change from the Bush administration.
We have to reverse many of the policies towards organized labor that we've seen these last 8 years, policies with which I've sharply disagreed.
The first of today's executive orders requires federal contractors to offer jobs to current employees if a contract changes. The next says federal contractors can't be reimbursed for using companies that try to influence workers who want to join a union. And the third order requires federal contractors to let workers know about their rights. President Obama says unions, workers, and employers have to work side by side.
This isn't an either-or proposition between the interests of workers and the interests of shareholders. That's the old argument. The new argument is that the American economy is not and has never been a zero-sum game. We can be competitive and lean and mean and still create a situation where workers are thriving in this country.
Opponents of the executive order says it's less about workers' rights and more about politics. Justin Wilson, managing director of the Center for Union Facts, a pro-business group.
Labor unions have a long wish list for the administration. The labor unions are looking for payback, and that's their words, not mine. In this case, it seems like some small administrative changes, but in general, this is a huge boon for the labor union movement and who loses out, businesses.
Proponents, however, say it's a major step forward. Chris Chafe is executive director of ChangeToWin.org, a coalition of 7 unions around the country.
Workers across the country won today because this administration made a fundamental signal and took real action to protect workers' rights on the job, to ensure that as taxpayers that their tax dollars are not going to be used for union busting, and also that that job security in the case of successorship in federally funded facilities is going to be protected and preserved.
Obama also announced the creation of a middle-class tax force headed by Vice President Joe Biden. The White House set up a website for the task force, astrongmiddleclass.gov, and its first meeting set for February 27th in Philadelphia will focus on green jobs. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
One provision in the stimulus would ensure that projects built with stimulus funds use U.S.-made products, and that stipulation has ignited a debate in the Senate. As FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports, free trade supporters say that kind of help is no help at all.
North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan introduced the Buy American measure into the Senate stimulus bill.
We're going to talk about now building roads and dams and schools and libraries and bridges. I very much hope that the steel and the iron and the products, the skid steer loaders and much more that are used for those projects are going to come from the factory floors in America. And it just seems logical to me that that's the purpose of trying to stimulate an economy.
Some of the companies that stand to benefit most from the measure are opposing it, fearing it would launch a trade war. Caterpillar, which cut more than 20,000 jobs in recent weeks, warned Congress that by embracing Buy American, they would undermine the industry's ability to export U.S. products overseas. And right now, U.S. companies are eyeing other countries' stimulus packages and hoping to get in on the action. Senator Kit Bond sits on the Appropriations Committee. Representing Missouri, he's not just thinking about heavy industry. He's worried about the impacts a Buy American provision would have on his state if it would ignite a global trade war.
I think that's very bad because if foreigners stop buying American wheat, corn, soybeans, our farmers would be crippled. Caterpillar wouldn't be able to sell, Boeing wouldn't be able to sell overseas.
The European Commission has already threatened countermeasures if the U.S. passes the Buy American provision. Many times in U.S. history, the government has kept out foreign competition to allow young or struggling industries to thrive. But more recently, the ethic of free trade has dominated. Rules enforced by the World Trade Organization further put a chill on protectionist measures. Nancy Gravatt, a spokesperson for the American Iron and Steel Institute, is surprised that companies like Caterpillar oppose the measure. She says her industry needs protective measures like Buy American to get back on its feet.
Because demand dropped off so dramatically in the fourth quarter of 2008, as a result of the drop in manufacture of cars, the slump in the home building industry, when you don't have new homes, you don't have appliances being made.
The Senate Buy American provision goes further than a similar measure included in the House stimulus bill, which passed Wednesday without a single Republican vote in favor. But it does allow for waivers in cases where American-made products are unavailable or would add significantly to the cost. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Iraqis go to the polls tomorrow in an election where some 14,000 people are competing for 440 provincial seats. Violence has already marked the run-up to these elections, which marks the first time Iraqi voters can pick specific individuals on a ballot since the U.S. invasion in 2003. Three Sunni Arab candidates running for provincial council seats were assassinated this week. That brings the death toll of Sunni candidates to four. Some say the murders are an effort to intimidate people before Election Day. Sunni Arabs boycotted provincial elections in 2005, and Shiites and Kurds ended up with disproportionate control, even in areas with larger Sunni populations. Riyad Jarrar is an Iraq consultant for the American Friends Service Committee. He spoke with KPFA's Mitch Jezerich about what might change this time in Iraq's political landscape.
Now, these elections will have an extremely different model. There are Sunnis and Shiites running together based on their politics, and there are other Sunnis, other Shiites who are running on other lists, different lists because of their politics. So those who tend to be more, for example, for keeping Iraq united with one central government and end the occupation are running together on the same list, whether they were religious or secular, whether they were Sunni or Shiite, or even if they were Arabs or Kurds or other ethnicities. And on the other hand, we have other people who are running in different lists who want to partition Iraq or keep foreign intervention. So it is pretty much more political. And I think this is important. It's a very important milestone to institutionalize this, because this has been happening for the last 3 years. Iraqis have been drifting away from sectarianism and ethnic politics and going closer to political politics, the thing that they have usually worked within, the framework that they usually knew politics in, not the sectarian one. So I think this will be the first milestone where this will be institutionalized. and we will see Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds and Christians working together in the same coalition.
Before we get into the details of a potential U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, I want to ask you about, I've heard people say that once the U.S. military leaves out of Iraq, this government that's there now is gone.
Well, I do agree. I mean, it will be changed radically. The few Sunnis and few Shiites who have been running the country in the executive branch during the last years have no capacity to run the country with no U.S. tanks protecting their little green zone and with no U.S. Airplanes and with no U.S. political support inside the country. So they will fall. I'm sure many of them...
Through the barrel of a gun or through the ballot box?
Well, both. I mean, I think many of them will run away because they know that they can't deal with the fury of Iraqis who are really angry, who view them as collaborators with foreign occupiers and view them as enemies of the people.
That was Raj Arar. He is an Iraqi blogger and consultant for the American Friends Service Committee. He spoke with KPFA's Mitch Jezerich about Saturday's provincial elections in Iraq. This is FSRN. Doctors treating survivors of Israel's recent attack on Gaza say they've never quite seen certain kinds of injuries before. A Norwegian doctor described wounds that appear to have been caused by a mine detonating, yet there was no shrapnel. A German doctor treating survivors in southern Gaza says that tiny particles can be found eating away at organs, rendering treatment ineffective. So what kind of weapon caused these injuries? Con Hallinan is an analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, and next week he'll publish a piece outlining what he says is Israel's use of so-called focused lethality weapons, that is, a type of weapon that causes shattering injuries on its victims with minimal explosive damage. In this FSRN exclusive, Hallinan describes some of the damage these weapons cause.
It's just horrendous. It sends out these microshrapnels, and it tends to blow limbs off. It produces kind of terrible... this Mad Gilbert, who's a Norwegian doctor in Gaza, says that it produces very severe fractures, and I'll actually quote him. The muscles are sort of split from the bones, hanging loose, and they also have quite severe burns, unquote. So you have the initial damage that the explosion does, and it causes generally multiple amputations, but that's only one level of it. Then apparently what happens is that the tungsten gets inside the body, and what doctors are finding is, even when they can save someone who has lost a limb or even two limbs, that they're seeing organ collapse, massive organ collapse. So when they open up people, they find these little kind of black spots on people's kidneys and on their liver and heart and things like that, and you can't remove them surgically, and they kill people. So you have this kind of second level of lethality. And then the third level, I mean, if you wanted to give a name for this bomb, I guess you could call it the cancer bomb, because what happens is that people develop a particularly deadly variety of cancer called a rhabdomyosarcoma, RMS, and it's a cancer that embeds itself very deeply into tissue, and it's very difficult to treat. In one experiment by the U.S. Department of Health, they took 92 rats, and they put these tungsten capsules, and little kind of bullets of tungsten, inside of them, and out of the 92 rats, 92 of them developed RMS, which is extremely unusual. So if you survive the initial blast, and if your organs don't, and you survive amputations, and your organs don't collapse, then the chances are that you won't live more than 5 or 6 months. So this is a pretty awful kind of weapon.
You know, the United States originally created these kinds of weapons. How do you think that Israel got a hold of it?
That's a very good question. The United States did it. It was developed by the U.S. Air Force and the University of California's Lawrence Livermore Lab. They started working on it in 2000. They got a working bomb in 2006. Now, there's some rumors that the Israelis used some bombs in 2006 when they invaded Lebanon. But we don't know that for certain, because there wasn't widespread use of it in any case. How did they get this bomb? Well, I don't think they came up with the bomb on their own. Now, either they were given the bomb straight out, they were given a license to produce the bomb, which is a possibility as well, or someone slipped them the specifications of how to make it. You know, it's not a terribly difficult concept, but it's a pretty sophisticated technology that you have to use. These, you know, for instance, the carbon fiber epoxy containers, that's pretty high tech. And the delivery system is pretty high tech. According to the witnesses in Gaza, almost all of them have been delivered by these drones, pilotless airplanes, which the Israelis have thousands and thousands and thousands of.
Khan Halanan is an analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus. You can hear our entire exclusive interview at fsrn.org. Israel has so far denied allegations that it's used these weapons. It also initially denied using white phosphorus during its recent incursion into Gaza, citing their adherence to international law. Israel was forced to admit, however, that it did in fact use the device after eyewitness accounts confirmed it. The ACLU of Colorado has filed a class action lawsuit against Weld County authorities for violating privacy rights following a raid in October of a tax services office. Local authorities seized tax records as well as computers and a hard drive because they had evidence that one of the clients was committing identity theft. Since then, the county DA and the sheriff have used evidence from that raid to seek out and arrest hundreds of undocumented immigrants, but the ACLU says that authorities are violating privacy rights by searching through thousands of confidential records. FSRN's Blake Wesley has the story.
Weld County law enforcement seized nearly 5,000 tax documents in a raid at Amelia's Tax Services last fall, as well as computers and a hard drive. Law enforcement officials say more than 1,300 people suspected of identity theft are being targeted in Operation Number Game, although only a few dozen have been arrested so far. Executive Director for the ACLU of Colorado, Catherine Hazuri, says authorities illegally search Amelia's Tax Services. Plaintiffs are demanding the county return the tax files.
Whether you are documented or not in this situation is not the issue. The issue is the privacy of those records. There's very sensitive information in those records, information that should not be seen by other people.
Immigrants' rights advocates point out Greeley is home to Swift Meatpacking Plant and a large agricultural industry. Member of the American Friends Service Committee, Jennifer Piper.
It was targeting legal permanent residents, people basically of Latino descent. Most of the folks who filed their taxes at Amalia's are of Latino descent, but many of them are citizens, legal permanent residents, people here on visas, and all of those folks had their records gone through.
Weld County officials defended the raid, saying they were tipped off after they're told an undocumented immigrant filed taxes with Amelia's Tax Services. Jennifer Finch is Relations Director for the Weld County DA.
Word on the street is you get refunds. You get money back from the government. Well, how does that work? Because you're working under somebody else's Social Security number. So the word is go to a particular tax preparer in town, and she will help you file your taxes. And she does that by applying for an ITIN, Individual Taxpayer Identification Number.
But the ACLU's Hazuri doesn't buy it. She says the IRS requires undocumented immigrants to file returns using Individual Taxpayer Identification Number. Hazuri says Weld authorities have violated the privacy of thousands of taxpayers and they want to see the documents destroyed or returned. For FSRN, I'm Blake Wesley.
Despite a rising number of deaths, law enforcement agencies across the country are still using tasers, sometimes against unarmed people. Critics say tasers haven't been adequately tested and that some authorities who use them don't fully understand the lethal danger involved. Africa Jones reports.
Last January, Sonoma County sheriffs in California were called to a disturbance at a group home serving the mentally disabled. Valerie Barber says her son, Jesse Hamilton, had not been taking his medication.
So he had a knife in his hand and he was scared because he's paranoid, schizophrenic, and he lifted up his knife and they tased him once. They're claiming that that tase did not work. So when they were done doing that, they shot him four times. After he had been tased and shot four times, they tased him two more times right up to his skin so they could handcuff him.
The death of Hamilton and hundreds of others have activists calling for a ban of tasers, says Carl Patrick, a member of Petaluma Cop Watch in Sonoma.
There have been two people who have been killed by tasers in Sonoma County in the last 2 months. We don't feel that it actually is a viable alternative to guns. It hasn't stopped crime. It hasn't stopped deaths at the hands of police. We feel it's actually increasing deaths.
A new study finds that the use of tasers by law enforcement may indeed be causing more deaths. Dr. Zian Sen, assistant professor of UCSF, co-authored the study.
We wanted to really look at real-world outcomes. Somewhat to our surprise, we found an over six-fold increase in these in-custody sudden deaths in the 50 cities that participated in our study. Also, we found a two-fold increase in officer shootings in the same time period.
Though researchers were unable to prove that tasers actually caused the deaths, the study has called into question the safety of tasers. Tasers are now used by more than 12,000 law enforcement bodies. The device has been marketed as a non-lethal alternative to guns. In a video on Taser International's website, Vice President of Training at the company, Rick Gilbalt, says that tasers save lives.
For over three decades now, taser technology has been tested and utilized by law enforcement, military, and professional security agencies around the world. It's this very technology that's been saving the lives of not only law enforcement and military personnel for years, but has also resulted in decreases in criminal shootings, suicides, and accidental deaths.
But Dalia Hashad, policy director with Amnesty International USA, says tasers can kill.
Between June 2001 and August 2008, we tracked 334 deaths. They're using it on people who are often part of vulnerable populations, meaning people who are elderly, people who are young, people who are under the influence of narcotics, people who are mentally ill.
Amnesty found that over 200 children were tasered between 2002 and 2005, including a six-year-old. Critics say that tasers have become a way of escalating nonviolent situations into violent ones. Valerie Barber.
They're being used in place of what used to be done, which is the talk down. Now they give one warning. If the person doesn't immediately respond, they tase. Tasers are also being used for compliance and not for self-defense by the cops. When you tell someone don't sit up and they start to sit up and you tase them just to make them do what you want them to do, that's different than if you're really going to be hurt.
Last June, Taser International for the first time was ordered to pay $6 million on a product liability claim for failing to warn users of the risk of multiple and prolonged discharges. This came after the death of Californian Robert Heston, who was tasered more than 20 times over the course of 60 seconds. Dalia Hashad says tasers need more research and police should understand that they can be deadly.
No police officer wants to find him or herself in a situation where they've taken out the taser weapon to use on someone and then they have a dead body and explanations to make.
Taser International did not return calls for comment by airtime. Amnesty International found that California was the state with the highest number of taser-related deaths in the nation, while Maricopa County in Arizona had the most deaths of any U.S. county. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
And that will do it for today's newscast. Special thanks today to Brian Edwards-Tiekert. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.